Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of August 23rd, 2013. For the next 4 weeks, we're going to talk about the American dream. I know, the phrase is a bit of a cliche, but it also resonates with millions of people. Getting educated, moving up, retiring well, and perhaps most symbolically, making a home. So today, that's where we're starting. Is owning a home still important to the American dream? We asked people across the country, what does home ownership mean?
It means that you've done well for yourself. You've made it to the next level.
When you think of a house, you got the backyard, little puppies in the back, barbecue, pool, and whatnot.
It just sends the message that you're grown up and settled in life and pretty happy with where you are.
It just makes the most financial sense, and it sets you up on a better, like, long-term financial trajectory to own your own home.
Yeah, that's kind of the pinnacle of I've made it if I can afford a home.
Owning a home means I will have to settle where I am at the moment. And right now, with me being a young adult, I'd rather, you know, kind of see where I'd like to live first instead of just settling where I am right now.
Having a house would be like I did something. I have something to show for myself or for what I've done, for my hard work.
You've made it, you're settled in life, you're on the path for financial security. Home ownership, as those people just shared, means more than just a picket fence or a two-car garage. It's emotional, personal, and aspirational. Even with the clouds that hung over the housing market the last few years, it was hard to get away from this idea that buying a place is part of the American dream. It's certainly part of the economic recovery. We still pay close attention to home sales, prices, inventory. This hour, we're looking at home ownership. What you should know before you buy, how you should think about costs, and whether it's the right thing for you. We'll begin with this news. In July, new home sales plunged by 13%, but overall, they were still 7% higher than last year. So, what do you need to ask yourself before you enter the market? We're getting some advice from Allison Rogers. She's a real estate agent and a columnist for Time.com. Welcome to the show, Allison.
It's wonderful to be here. I appreciate it.
When I'm thinking about buying a house, I sort of got that feeling. How do you tell people what's the right moment to get in? How do they know?
Sometimes people have a desire to own a house. You have to remember that purchase of your single family home isn't an investment. It's a consumption. I would certainly recommend that people have saved up a 10% down payment and feel that they're going to stay in the house for at least 5 years.
So once you've got that, there are a lot of other costs here. I mean, you've got to get the mortgage. How do you tell people to go about being prepared, and what other costs might come down the road toward them?
First-time homeowners are always surprised at how expensive it is to own a piece of property, partly because the house knows that you own it and everything breaks at the same time. So I would highly recommend renting the Money Pit with Tom Hanks so you can laugh. But basically, when you're considering purchasing, ask the current homeowner for his or her utility bills, his or her property tax bills, and also factor in the idea that you'll probably be making one major repair a year. I would just add in maybe 2-3% of the house's purchase price in my head as annual maintenance.
So all of those things that you don't think about, you try to sort of do a little worksheet and know what the extras are.
Exactly. For maintenance, for example, if you're buying a $400,000 house, I would think of wanting to have $8,000 in annual maintenance costs. That sounds like a lot, but if you're replacing a roof or you have boiler problems, it really starts to add up.
We get a lot of emails from people nowadays who are looking at mortgage rates that have been very low and they're starting to kind of inch up. And people get nervous saying, I got to get in now. What do you say to them?
Well, Lizzie, the first thing I would tell those people is to remember that rates are still historically very low. We've seen a bounce from 3.5% to 4.5%, which is very scary if you're thinking of buying. But historically, anything below 6% is still a very low mortgage rate. I wouldn't use the rise in rates as a reason to be too hasty in my decision.
So it shouldn't be something that causes people to panic?
No, I wouldn't panic, and I wouldn't make a decision you're going to regret based on just seeing those numbers move around.
So in your frame of mind, people should be thinking about a house as a place to live, a place to build a family, not a way to build wealth.
Yes. Building wealth is a wonderful extra. And I do think it's okay for people to think of a house as a way to force themselves to save. If you're paying off a 30-year fixed mortgage, that in essence is causing you to save some money, but I wouldn't expect price appreciation. The price appreciation that we got in this country in the 90s and the aughts really was whipped cream on top of the sundae. It wasn't something you should have expected, and you shouldn't necessarily expect it to repeat.
Allison Rogers is a real estate columnist for Time.com and a real estate agent for DG Neary Realty. Thank you so much, Allison.
Thank you, Lizzie. I appreciate it.
What else do you need to know about buying a home? One suggestion, ask your real estate agent to walk you through homes that have recently sold where you're looking so you can get a sense of price, condition, and value. That's just one of the tips you can find at marketplacemoney.org. Click on our home buying checklist. You just heard our last guest say that you should buy a home as a place to live, not as a way to build wealth. But the reality is, home equity is often the biggest asset that middle and lower income households have. That asset took a big hit during the recession, leaving people wondering if home ownership is the right choice. Ray Bashara is a senior advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, and he's written extensively about this. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I'm gonna start big picture here and just throw this one at you. Who should buy a house? Should low and middle income families look at home ownership as a goal for themselves?
I think home ownership remains a really important part of the American dream, but it's clearly not for everybody. And I think low income people in particular need to think twice about home ownership. There's a lot of things they need to think about and be ready for before they buy a home.
Walk me through that thought process. What should they be thinking about?
You know, you have to be financially ready. Do you have sufficient savings? Are your debts at a manageable level? Are your assets somewhat diversified? You want to make sure you don't have all of your assets in housing.
Thinking about assets in a broad way, savings or planning for education, those may be things that are, frankly, beyond the means of folks who are trying to get through the everyday and feed their families. Where should home ownership rank in terms of a financial goal?
I think that especially if you're lower income, you do not want to start with home ownership as your first financial goal. My sense is that you want to make sure you have quality financial services. If you're going to a payday lender or a check casher, that's not a route to a healthy balance sheet. You want to make sure you have savings. You want to make sure your debts are at a manageable level. You want to make sure your credit score is good. And if possible, you know, save for your kids' college or for continuing your own education. My sense is that once you've done those things, you have other kinds of assets on your balance sheet. You have manageable levels of debt. Then I think it's appropriate to think about home ownership.
There's a big philosophical question here if we look from 30,000 feet. Is a home a way to build wealth or is it a place to live? You've looked at this a lot. Where do you come down?
If you look at how different classes of assets have performed since 1983, you'll find that financial assets and stocks have returned about 7%. Pensions about 4%, business assets about 2%. But if you go down to homes, residential real estate, it's only about 1.6%. So if your point is to make money, home ownership is not really the recommended route. But keep in mind, however, if you hold on to that asset over the longer term, the equity will build up, and you can use that equity to finance higher education or to start a business or to get yourself through retirement.
There's also research that shows that people who own homes tend to have more stability, their kids go to college, they save better, they pass kind of that legacy of savings on to their children. So are we talking about a more, I guess, textured and nuanced question here than just making the mortgage payments?
Well, right. A recent study found that when housing values were rising, you know, those values contributed to higher rates of college attendance. But I would point out, too, that we have just as many studies showing that it doesn't just have to be home ownership that provides those kinds of benefits to families, including low-income families. Simple savings accounts, overall health of your balance sheet, like your net worth. We have found, for example, that net worth turns out to be one of the strongest predictors of economic mobility in America. We've also found that even very small amounts of savings can lead to college, higher rates of college attendance and completion, even for low-income families. So the point here is that we have to think about developing healthy balance sheets for families.
So renting could be perfectly fine if you're doing a lot of other things.
Absolutely. And I'm pleased to see that there is now greater attention to finding affordable rental properties for families and that public policy might be supporting that. I think that's a very healthy approach. Many families are not ready for home ownership, and I think we need to make sure they have affordable and quality places to live until they are.
Ray Bishara, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Ray Bishara is a senior advisor at the St. Louis Fed, where he also directs the Center for Household Financial Stability. On today's show, we're talking about home ownership. What does it mean? Is it the right choice for you? Buying a house is a complicated process, and it brings up a lot of questions. So today, we've invited Luis Barajas to answer some of those questions for our listeners. Luis is a personal finance expert here in LA, and he's a familiar guest on this program. Welcome back, Luis.
Thank you, Lizzie.
So we've been asking questions on Facebook to have people tell us about what confuses them about this housing market. And a number of listeners wrote to us with questions about short sales. Now, I want to tell you about one. Joe. He's a first-time home buyer in Washington, D.C., and he wrote in asking us about bidding on a short sale condo back in February. He's worried not only because the sale has taken a long time, but also because he's heard rumors that at the last second, the price can go up. So why don't you start by kind of explaining what a short sale is and, you know, is this a good way to get into the housing market?
Well, technically, a short sale is when someone owns a home and they're underwater, meaning that if they were to sell their house, they'd have more debt than they would get from the proceeds of the home. So now they're trying to get rid of the house. They maybe have lost their job and they're handing it back to the bank. And so what the wonderful thing is in the year 2013, this is the last year that we'll be able to do this, is that any debt that you will have to incur from getting rid of the house or selling the house, you will not be liable for it. You won't have to pay the taxes on it because usually with this thing called debt forgiveness. And if they forgive a certain amount of debt, you have to report that difference on your tax return and pay taxes on that amount. So until the end of this year, you have that on a primary residence. So everybody's trying to hurry up and get the short sales done as quickly as possible right now.
But what about this question of can the price go up at the last minute? I mean, that seems to be Joe's worry here.
Well, it's not that the price can go up. What happens is that when you bid on a home that's in a short sale, what they're going to do is they're going to need a couple of things. First of all, it's got to get approved by the bank. Secondly, it's got to approved if there's other liens on that property. The second or the third have to approve it. If it's in a condo or homeowners association, they have to approve. So it's a lengthy process. And at the same time, what happens is that they also have to do an appraisal, and then the broker has to do an appraisal who's putting a bid on that property. And so it becomes a lengthy process. It usually takes it 3 to 6 months. And so what's happening here with Joe is that he might need to just kind of, you know, go with the flow right now. They're going to try to close this property probably within the next month or so. But yes, you're right. The banks may say right now, because we're in a different kind of environment, interest rates are going up and property values are going up and it's a seller's market, they may not want to give him or accept his offer. They might want to wait a few more months to see if anybody else comes in with a higher offer. So it might be true. But again, you know, banks right now really kind of want to get rid of these properties and sell them. But there's a process there, and it takes 3 to 6 months.
So that timeline's
kind of okay. That's a reasonable time, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to move on to another question from a first-time buyer. Our first caller, Jen, she is in San Francisco. Hey, Jen, what do you do in the Bay Area?
Oh, hi. I work in research in Mountain View. So, yes, I am a first-time home buyer. And basically, my husband and I have been looking for townhomes or condos in the San Francisco Bay Area for the last several months. And so our challenge is that we're using the VA mortgage benefit.
Oh, because your husband's in the military, right?
He was.
Okay.
Yeah. He's been discharged since 2006. But since we're actively looking right now, our challenge is that we seem to be, you know, the VA mortgage benefit just isn't considered. We're basically at the bottom of the pile.
And you're in a very competitive housing market over there.
Correct. We are in a very competitive housing market. We have multiple buyers, and usually we just get, we put in an offer, but basically we get lost out to all cash offers. So I'm just wondering if Lewis has some advice for us or for other people who are trying to use the VA mortgage benefit, if he has any tips or suggestions.
Yeah. Well, I do have some tips and suggestions here, but I want to share with you again, it's a seller's market. And the problem is that a seller who's going to take multiple offers is usually always going to take a cash offer first, because that's guaranteed. They can close this property within the next 30 days. Whether it's a VA loan or a conventional loan, they'll normally take anywhere from 30 to 45 days to close. And so I want to let you know that VA loans are wonderful loans. Years ago, it used to be that everybody was afraid of VA loans. And so my suggestion to you is to work with a lender who really understands VA loans, but also to work with the real estate broker who's out there, you know, getting you a property and who knows that they can close this as quickly as possible by going through as fast, by getting the right appraiser to come in and appraise the property as quickly and to shorten down that time period. So it always comes down to who you're working with, who the specialists are. So again, just make sure that the broker you're using is the VA specialist, the lender is the VA specialist, and do not give up. There are a lot of homes out there right now, but I understand what you're saying. It's a seller's market, a lot of people coming in with cash, but it's not because of the VA loan. It's because you're competing against all cash buyers. But that'll stop soon, and you'll get into a piece of property, but you just can't give up.
Jen, what's your reaction to that? Does that help you?
Yeah, that does. And we are working with a lender and a broker that is pretty experienced with VA loans. So I think, you know, from what I'm taking away is that it's just, you know, a lot of patience. And sometimes it's just the luck of the draw.
That's what it is right now. Yeah.
And
so, but again, a lot of people don't know about VA loans. And again, you can go in with no money down. You know, they've got concessions that they'll pay for you. So they're wonderful loans. And if other people don't know, go to va.gov and you'll get some great, great information.
Okay.
Jen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right, Lewis, we have a couple of additional callers who want to talk to you, get some more advice. If you could just hang on for a bit, stick around.
I will be sticking around.
My guest this hour is personal finance expert Lewis Barajas, and we're taking your questions about home ownership. And our next caller is Steve in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how's it going?
So you wrote us that you are renting right now, but you're thinking about getting into the market. Tell me a little bit about your current living situation.
Yeah, so my wife and I are recently married, and, you know, going along with that, we'd like to start a family, purchase a home in the next few years. Right now, we're in a pretty good place where we could kind of use that as a starter home, the rental we're in. But, you know, we have areas we definitely would like to live in. They're, you know, close to our work, kind of in good school districts. But we're getting more and more concerned with the rising cost of housing and mortgage that would probably price us out after, you know, things being historically low and now starting to go back up.
Well, this is Lewis. This is something people have been worried about. They're watching interest rates edge back up. What are your thoughts for Steve?
Well, let's talk about interest rates, right? I mean, as of, I think, this morning, the interest rates were at 4.59 a year ago. That's for a 30-year fix. A year ago, they were about 3.6. And so they have gone up. But not only have interest rates gone up, because of low inventory, the property values have gone up. So we've got a double whammy here. And then also, as property values go up, the property tax that you have to pay on that property goes up. And then you got homeowners insurance that's going to go based on the price of the home. So it's really getting interesting out there for people who really are first-time home buyers.
You're making me nervous for Steve. What does he need to know?
Well, what Steve needs to know is that at the same time, it's all relative, right? We have interest rates that are still low. Even if you take a look at what we're doing is we're comparing against some of the lowest interest rates we've had in decades a year ago. Now it's 4.59. It's still a very low interest rate. It's very competitive. The problem is it's just looking around for some place that is affordable to him. And when you're buying a home, I don't want people to focus just on the interest rate. I want to focus on their affordability. Can they afford it? What kind of jobs do they have? Are those jobs consistent? And take a look at and create a home budget to see what it's going to entail to really own that home.
Yeah, I mean, so you're probably saying that it's better to kind of, if we can save up more money for down payment, that might be a better option than be aggressive now with a smaller down payment.
Right. What you want to do is, again, take a look at the economic decision you're going to make and not get caught up with sometimes the rising interest rates or the rising home values, because that would cause the problem with the subprime mess we had a few years back. And so you want to retain at least some common sense and a level-headed decision-making when take a look at how much you can really afford. So in case you lose your job or something, you can still figure out how to make payments. You'll have cash reserves. Take a look at the big picture, not just focus on, I've got to make this decision because it's a knee-jerk reaction to rising interest rates.
Lewis, I want to just ask you, what's your rule of thumb for what's a good amount percentage-wise for a down payment?
Well, I mean, if you can afford it and you can put less money into the house, I would do it. If you can go with a 5% down or a VA, for example, a VA loan, you can go with no money down, but you can still make the payments and make the property taxes and it's still affordable for your budget, then I would do that. It really doesn't depend on how much of a down payment. It's also, again, affordability.
All right. Steve, I hope that's helpful to you, and good luck in your search. Keep looking, man.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay, we've been talking to people who want to buy, who are looking into the market. I want to hear from a caller who owns her house, and she has some other questions here. Our last caller is Leslie. She's in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
So you own a home. How long have you owned it, and was it a good investment for you?
The home has been a good investment in that I've been here. It's been 25 years or so that I've had the home.
Wow.
I did go through a divorce, which changes everything, so I had to refinance the home to get it in my own name. Did that in 2004, and because of, as everything was that way at that time, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to qualify, but I was. They were taking everybody. My credit rating is awesome. I ended up deciding on a 5-1 ARM. I had returned to school, and I figured by then, you know, I should be able to have the income and get into a fixed. Due to budget cuts and more, I experienced a layoff a couple years ago, and I've been unsuccessful in finding regular employment. So what I'm trying to figure out now, I've been fortunate in that these last years rates have gone down. So even though it adjusted back in 2009, each year, interest rates have gone down a bit. Starting to creep up, I would love to be able to refinance. But since I'm not what I call, I'm income challenged because my income, I don't show what I'm assuming mortgage providers are wanting these days, that it might be tough for me to qualify.
Well, let's see what Lewis has to say. Lewis, what are your thoughts on Leslie's situation?
Well, Leslie, you know, you've got a great, great question here because I think a lot of people are in your situation. And for most people that don't know what a 5-1 ARM is, I think when she got the loan, it was fixed for 5 years and then
Correct.
It converted to an adjustable.
Correct.
Do you know what the cap is or how high your adjustable can go to?
Each year it can go up 2 percentage points.
Okay. And do you know what the maximum cap would be?
You know, I'm sorry, I don't.
Well, that's something that you'd like to find out as well, because I actually have seen some of these loans where they can cap out as high as 12% or even or bigger than that.
Okay.
So what happens is this. Right now, you can go to a lender and take a look at and apply for a fixed rate, but what's your current interest rate that you're paying on this loan?
3.125.
Okay. So that's a wonderful rate, and I don't want people
exactly.
to think that all adjustable rate mortgages are bad mortgages. And again, we're not going to see interest rates rise a lot over the next couple of years. We know that, right? The Fed's kind of saying we still have to keep interest rates in control. And so right now, if that loan, that interest rate allows you to stay in that home, pay a lower mortgage and the principal and interest every month, you're comfortable, you're not feeling the stress of maybe being underemployed, then it might be okay to stay there. But you want to take a look at, though, if you can convert it to a fixed rate, maybe wait a little bit longer. Maybe the rates will come down and then try again. Remember, you've got probably a lot of equity. What you're telling me, you've stayed in that home for a long time. That tells me you must have a lot of equity in that house. And you've probably, since you got that loan in 2004, you've probably paid down a lot of the principal.
Yes, I owe less than 100, and the home is worth about 300.
Right. And as we know, most lenders don't really lend on the equity as much as right now is the black and white is the income, right? How much money you're earning and what you can afford to pay.
And that's what my concern is.
Yeah.
I'm subbing, so I'm bringing in income.
Right.
I've not been in danger of missing any payments.
Well, that's great.
Right.
And I have an excellent credit score. However, if they're looking for longevity of employment,
You know what they're going to look for, Leslie? They're going to take a look at what other debts you have as well. So you want to take a look at it. It's just not your FICO
score.
Well,
that's all I have at this point.
Then, Leslie, you would be an excellent candidate. But again, I would talk to somebody who really is going to take your best interest at heart and say, you know, right now, a 3.1 interest rate is much, much better than applying for a 4.5. And if interest rates are going to maintain the same, your rate's not going to go up that much over the next couple of years. And when things get better for you, you feel more comfortable. You might think about at that time refinancing.
Well, and that's what I've been doing over these past years, is just kind of sitting it out and kind of waiting.
Sounds like you're doing the right thing.
Well, I hope so.
You are. And again, just be patient. If for some reason you really feel that interest rates are really going to start to go up, find out what that cap rate, how high your loan can go. And then if you get scared a little bit, you can go ahead and refi. I think you'd be an excellent candidate for refinance.
And you think I could qualify without trying to say I need somebody else to
great,
sign with me?
You said you got a great score, no debt other than the home. You owe less than $100,000. You've been in that home for a long time.
Yes.
I think you'd be an excellent candidate.
Those are wonderful things to hear.
Well, I hope we made you feel a little better, Leslie. Thank you for calling us. Keep us updated on how you're doing, okay?
Thank you very much.
Take care, Leslie.
Bye.
Lewis, I want to put a slightly different version of Leslie's situation to you. What if you're talking about someone who has a higher rate on a mortgage, maybe a fixed rate mortgage that they got that's up there in the 6% realm? Should they be thinking about still trying to get in with these lower rates and refinance?
Well, yes. Here's the thing, though, that most people have, in the last 2 or 3 years, have refinanced 2 or 3 times. Every single time the rates went down like 0.5 point or 0.75 point, they refinanced. Very few people out there, unless they were underwater. But again, they can go through the HARP loan program in which they are, if they owe a little bit more, they can still refinance their property. There are other platforms out there that can help them. They need to look into that as quickly as possible. I would consider doing it now. And the reason other people might not have done it is because again, their property value wasn't as high. They didn't have enough equity. And now in the last 6 months, we've seen property values just go
up
like 10, 15%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All All right, Lewis, thank you so much. It was great to have you here today to talk through these questions.
Always my pleasure. Yeah, I'd love to help people out here, and they've got some wonderful questions. Every time I come and sit here, the questions just keep getting a little bit harder and harder, though, I think, to answer.
Well, that's good. That's why I keep you coming back. Lewis Barajas is a certified financial planner, and he's the author of several books about finance, including My Street Money, A Street-Level View of Managing Your Money from the Heart to the Bank. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
TV has given us so many iconic images of American homes, from the Golden Girls to the Cosby Show. Have some fun and test your knowledge of famous TV homes at marketplacemoney.org. And if your American dream has nothing to do with being a homeowner, let us know. We're asking people to tell us about their personal pursuits of happiness on Twitter. Tweet us at Radio Piggy Bank and be sure to include the hashtag #MyAmericanDream. On today's show, we're looking at home ownership and what it means as a part of the American dream. There's probably no better way to do that than to go out and actually look at a house that's for sale. So we're in Eagle Rock, that's a neighborhood in LA, and we're looking at one single family home. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Are you Tracy?
I'm Tracy King with Telus Properties.
Hi, hey, I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Ooh, it smells so nice in here.
Cookies.
Does the cookie smell really work? People have that kind of, here I am in a place that smells like home.
It really does work.
Amazing. It's really so does. Welcoming. So tell me about this house we're in.
This is a 1991 built, 3,700 square foot, four-bedroom, four-bath house, three bedrooms upstairs, one bedroom downstairs. It has amazing views.
Yeah, we're looking out on sort of rolling hills, and you can see lots of greenery. It's really pretty.
I'd love to take you up to the master.
All right, let's do it. Oh, my goodness.
This is the master. Vaulted ceilings, great views, gas fireplace. And then the master bath, which is to die for, heated floor tiles, fog-free shaving mirror in the shower, Victoria and Albert Barcelona freestanding soaking tub with phenomenal views that's out to Mount Wilson. In the winter, you'll see snow-capped mountains out here.
And what's the asking price for a house like this?
This one's listed for $849,000. We came on the market on Sunday. We had our first open house Sunday, and we have three offers in hand.
Wow.
Yes, that's the kind of market we're in.
We've heard a lot of stories about people coming in with all cash offers on houses. What kind of offers are you seeing?
We're seeing mostly 20% down to 30 to 40% down. But in the last couple of years, an amazing number of the houses that I've sold have been for cash and in all price ranges. We'd sold one for, well, it was going to be for cash for $390,000. At the last minute, they got a loan. There's quite a bit of that going on. But we also sold another one in the spring for $920,000 cash.
Almost $1 million cash.
Yes, in Highland Park, a very cool house. And it was listed for $799. We had several offers.
So listed for $799, and somebody came in more than $100,000 over the price point.
Yes. We had several offers in the 800s right out of the box. And then when we gave the best and final counter offer, we ended up with three over $900.
Wow.
Yes.
And so, when people come through like that, are they prepared? I mean, are they sort of pre-approved and you know, ready for bear?
Yes, yes. In today's market, you better be ready with your pre-approval, your credit reports, your proof of funds, And the ones who really do well now are the ones who have actual underwriting approval. So they're not pre-approved, they're actually approved. All they have to do is identify the property and get the appraisal done.
When someone comes into a house like this, what are you watching, you know, in their eyes to know, I got them, that's it?
Well, buyers don't want us to know that. So they work very hard at looking stern or bored. They don't want us to know how really in love they are until they write us the love letter when they send in the offer.
Love letter.
Yes, yes. Mm. Buyers today will do photos with the kids, with the dog. Lovely, lovely, and lovely letters. This is who we are. This is why we love your house. This is what we want to do when we get here. This is how we see ourselves living here. Nice letters. I'm a little bit cynical. I think that same letter's probably been used on many properties until they actually get one. But buyers today, I mean, it's a grueling process. And they'll think they're going to get a house at, you know, whatever price they're starting at, say $600,000, and they're thinking they'll look in the $600,000 range and they'll bid less and they'll try and then they'll lose out and they'll lose out again. Some people we've talked to have made 20 offers. And then they'll get to the point where they're like, this is it. We're not going to go through this process anymore. Let's just kill it. And they offer as much as they possibly can, and they get the house.
What's the average time something stays on the market? I'm getting the sense that things move pretty quickly.
The average days on market for houses that sell is about 40 to 60. My average is less. My average is about almost half of that. Why?
Why?
Pricing strategy. Yeah, I like to price things so that we do get multiple offers. And that generally happens very quickly. So a well-priced property will be on the market at most 2 weeks.
You've been doing this a while.
24 years.
You know how to sell a house.
Thank you.
That's realtor Tracy King. And something we saw on the way out. Little water bottles branded with the photo of the house, the address, and a few selling points, like the avocado tree and the balcony and that view. Think of it as a realtor's equivalent of those love letters. Here's something to remember. When most of us buy a home, we're essentially getting help from the government in the form of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two government-backed companies that subsidize and underwrite mortgages, including one that is the bedrock of the real estate market, the 30-year fixed rate. That loan makes up 80% of mortgages in the U.S. So when we talk about home ownership, we're essentially talking about the 30-year, because most consumers have used this mortgage to get a home. Right now, Congress is trying to figure out whether it should still exist. We've asked Elise Glink to explain. She's a personal finance expert and author. Thanks for coming on, Elise.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
When I think about a mortgage, I automatically think of the 30-year mortgage. Is it going to go away? What's happening to it?
I can't imagine that this tool will ever go away. I know that there's been talk about eliminating it, and truth be told, most Americans don't keep their mortgages for 30 years. The typical American household will keep a mortgage for usually somewhere between 5 and 7 years. But now that mortgage interest rates are near historic lows, they're not quite at the historic low, but very close to it, I think we're going to see these mortgages kept for a long time.
The government is trying to wind down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And that really changes the mortgage picture out there because most of the new loans that have been taken out in the past few years have been backed by Fannie and Freddie. So what could mortgages look like if Fannie and Freddie go private or have a really diminished role?
We're going to see a winding down of Fannie and Freddie, and in its place is going to be a system that I think will look very much like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, except it's going to be not Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So what will end up happening is that private entities that step in and perform the secondary mortgage market function, and it'll probably be names that you know, like Bank of America or Chase. The big banks are going to want to have a part of this, I think.
If I'm thinking about buying a house and trying to figure out the financing end of it, what's going to change for me?
I think what you'll see with whatever replaces Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are additional charges and fees that are going to go into this. And so ultimately that will fall to the buyers. And so I think buyers will see mortgages that are going to be more expensive.
So it could be harder for me or for someone else to get a mortgage, or at least to get a mortgage at a cheaper rate?
The cost of mortgages is going to go up. We see interest rates already going up. That's making mortgages more expensive. And I think the fees associated with it are going to go up. We've been in an extraordinary period of competition and historic low interest rates that I don't think we'll ever see again. And the reason we're not going to see them in our lifetimes, hopefully, is that the economy completely tanked. And so the super low interest rates are a direct result of the Federal Reserve Bank buying $85 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities and other kinds of instruments every single month to keep interest rates this low. When the economy improves, that's going to stop and costs are going to go up. And so by that in itself, it will be more expensive and more difficult for people to qualify for mortgages.
Spin forward for me, say, 5-10 years. What's the standard mortgage going to look like?
I don't know that there's any way to know right now. But looking out 10 years, if I had to lay odds on it, I would say there will still be a 30-year mortgage. People will still be able to qualify, but they're going to have to qualify based on what they actually earn and can afford to repay. And we went through a long period of time where all you needed was a pulse and a good credit score, and you could leverage up your income by 10 times. I think those days are gone, and I don't think you're going to see that 10 years down the line.
Elise Glink is a syndicated columnist and publishes thinkglink.com. Elise, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Say you want to read a book on the back porch of your new house. You're in luck. This summer, we asked our friends in finance to share what they're reading.
Hi there. I'm Farnoosh Tarabi, personal finance author of You're So Money. I just finished reading a great book called The Unfinished Revolution, written by Kathleen Gerson. She's a professor of sociology at NYU. In it, she chronicles her interviews with over 100 young men and women between the ages of 18 and 32 on the subjects of career and family and time and money. I found it to be a really in-depth, insightful take on how Gen Y has been influenced by culture and family. Gerson's conclusions are uplifting in some ways, but I think also a little depressing. I won't give anything away, but for anyone who's really curious like me about how this new generation thinks, The Unfinished Revolution offers some great context and some unique insights.
Hi, this is Lynette Kalfani-Cox. I'm the founder of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. One of my favorite books is Paying for College Without Going Broke by Kalman Cheney. The book really is appealing to me professionally and personally. On the professional front, I appreciated the fact that he offers line-by-line instructions for how to fill out the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid. That's the all-important form that consumers need to know in order to get money for college. At a personal level, I also appreciated, as a mom, the fact that Mr. Cheney gave a lot of secrets and details about the inner workings of the financial aid system and how you can use some of the rules and regulations to your own advantage to get more money for college.
And next week, we'll look at the cost of higher education, answering your questions about student debt, financial aid, and how to save. You can be part of that conversation. Send us your stories and comments on our Facebook page or write in to marketplacemoney.org. And while you're there, you can see our entire summer reading list. Ask anyone, realtor, friend, family member, if you want to get into the market, you have to do your homework. But now you don't have to do it from home. House hunting has gone mobile with apps to help you buy or rent. Katie Roof is a business and technology journalist, and she's here to do an app roundup. Hi, Katie.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, so explain the world of house hunting apps for me. It seems crazy that I can hold a smartphone and look for a house that way. How does this work?
Right, it's gotten so much easier these days. There's a lot of apps in the App Store right now. You know, you have the big ones like Zillow and Trulia. And they each have four different apps that you can choose from. Some of them are for home buying. Some of them are for renting. And you can use your location, and it will help find listings near you. And then you can set your criteria. You know, maybe if you're in New York, you want a roof deck on your building, and you can help find listings in your area that are suitable for you.
So I can say I want this school district or this zip code and plug in that data and see it on some of these apps?
Yeah, definitely. And the website out there that's good for that is Block Avenue, which shows information about schools and crime and different neighborhood data that you might find interesting. Trulia and Zillow also have more detailed information on that on their websites. And some of them, like Lovely, will alert you once you've stored your preferences in there. It will tell you when a home becomes available that meets your search criteria. And then there are others like HomeSnap, where you can take a picture of a home that you see out there already, and it will show you information about that home. Is it for sale? What photos of the inside of the home look like?
So it's kind of like a reverse search engine.
Exactly. So I thought that was kind of creative. It's a Shazam for homes, they're calling it. They have 90 million homes, apparently, that you can take a picture of, and it will show you everything you need to know. There's also a social component to it, so you can connect with your friends and say, hey, what do you think of this house?
I like this one. Do you like the plants? Do you like the color? Whatever.
Sometimes you already know what you want, and this app just tells you more about that home.
I gotta ask you, do you have a favorite? What do you like the best?
I like Trulia. I think it has the best design, and I think nationally it's pretty comprehensive. They have another app that's a mortgage calculator. Mm. So if you're buying a home, you can calculate, A, can you afford it? I mean, that's important. And it will help you figure out, you know, what your down payment's going to be, how much you could save if you're going to refinance. And then all of this will connect you to someone who can help give you this rate. So that really makes things a lot less complicated. Zillow and Bankrate also have similar mortgage calculator apps.
It's not just the search engine part, but actually kind of funneling you into the ownership process.
Even before you're looking, actually, it could be good to take a look at these apps and say, you know, how much can I afford right now? This is how much I make. This is my credit score. This is the area I'm looking at. So what are the property taxes? It will help you figure all of that out quickly, and then it will help you find people that will offer you a loan at that rate.
A lot of these apps are based around buying a house. Do they work for renters, too?
Yes, and Trulia and Zillow, they both have a separate app. They have one for home buyers and one for renters. If you're looking to rent, you only see rental listings. If you're looking to buy, you only see listings for buying.
Katie Roof is a business and technology journalist in New York. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for Marketplace Money this week. Let us know what you think of the show on our Facebook page or at marketplacemoney.org. You can follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggybank. Next time, our series on the American Dream continues with a conversation about paying for college. But today, we close with this famous American dreamer before the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fargali, with Lindsay Foster-Thomas and Daryl Perinata. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is APM.